I heard about a man several hundred years ago who lived in Boston, Massachusetts, and he heard about a wonderful thing called Niagara Falls. Niagara Falls was an even more wonderful thing a couple hundred years ago than it is now. For one thing, that was before the invention of hydroelectricity, which now takes over half of the flow of the Niagara River away from the falls. It was twice the spectacle it is now in those days. Also, that was before the invention of the Wax Museum. So Clifton Hill looked really placid and pastoral. And it was a spectacular sounding thing, Niagara Falls. So this man who lived in Boston decided he just needed to see it. And so he purposed to journey there. This was a long time ago. So he decided to walk. And the distance from Boston to Niagara Falls is about 700 miles. And if he was a good walker, he could cover perhaps 20 miles a day. So 5 days into the journey, he'd be 100 miles down the road, and he had 600 miles left to go. So all in all, it was going to take him over a month to get there. And he thought it was worth it, because he had heard about the spectacular sight, one of the modern wonders of the world, Niagara Falls. When he was 7 miles from the falls, which is just, a couple of hours of walking left, he thought, to his great excitement, that he could hear the roar of the falls in the distance, but he wasn't sure. And so he stopped a man who was working in the field and said to him, "Sir, I think I hear the roar of the great Niagara Falls. Is that in fact what I'm hearing?" And to his great astonishment, what the man in the field said was, "I don't know. It might be. It might not be. I don't know. I've never been." And the man from Boston was totally stunned to think that someone could be just a two-hour walk from this spectacular sight and never bother taking the walk to get there, even though people were coming from miles and miles away, hundreds and hundreds of miles away to see the sight. It seemed to him a stunning sort of thing. And I'm thinking that there must have been a whole lot of people just like that man in the field living around Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and in fact all over that part of the world, when the Magi came to find the Christ child, as we heard read from the Gospel of Matthew. I'd like us to think tonight about the wisdom of those men who traveled a great distance to see a spectacular sight. It has always been in the mind of Christians the central event in human history, or the beginning of the central event in human history, the birth of Christ, which was, of course, the beginning of the life of Christ, which culminated in the death of Christ and his resurrection. And the way that Christians understand the history of the world sees that life, beginning with that birth, as the very center of the story we call human history. And, of course, it makes perfect sense when you consider the Christian perspective on it, because there, Christians say, God himself wrote himself into the script. If we see the whole long, spectacular, horrible story of human history as a play that has been written by a playwright, God being the playwright, the birth of Christ is the point in the story where the author writes himself in as a character and plays a very pivotal role in turning the course of events forever. This is the significance of the birth of Christ and what makes our celebration tonight and tomorrow so significant. So there were a number of people who we call wise men who got it right and took the time to go and see the Christ child. And I want us to think about them tonight. First of all, we need to clear the slates and recognize that there's actually a whole lot we don't know about them. When we think about the wise men, we typically think about three men in royal robes with crowns sitting on camels in the nighttime and pointing to the sky. You probably have never got a Christmas card with a picture of wise men galloping their camels in the daytime. It just doesn't come into our minds. But they stand on their camels, and sit on their camels, the camels standing still in the night sky. That's how we picture them. But lots that we have in our minds about the wise men we are speculating on and don't have any record to support the idea. For starters, we don't know how many there were. Traditionally, it says there were three, but that's a very speculative sort of thing. The reason that everyone thinks there are three wise men is that there were three gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh, and it just stands to reason that each brought one gift. But the text doesn't say that there were three gifts. It says there were gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, And we're left to wonder how many wise men there were. There might have been 8, and 7 of them brought gold, and then the 8th guy, just to do something different, brought a twin pack of frankincense and myrrh. There's no way of telling from the fact that there were gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh how many there were. We just know that there were more than one. There was at least 2. There might have been 10 or 12. We don't know exactly what they were. The scriptures say that they were magi, which is the plural of the word magos, which means sort of magician. In fact, our word magician is really linked to that word. And they were considered to be magicians, it seems, because they were very involved in the healing arts. But they got to their healing arts through astronomy and astrology. They studied the heavens. They came to conclusions about what was going on in the world because of what was going on in the sky. And then out of that, they came up with ideas about how people could be healed of their diseases. They were handy people to know. You could get your horoscope read and a prescription filled all at the same time. We don't really know very much about them, except that that's the sort of people they were, astrologers, astronomers, and healers. And we don't know where they came from. It seems they came from the east, but it's not entirely clear. They talk about seeing a star in the east, but it's not clear from how they say it, whether they were in the east when they saw the star, or the star was in the east when they saw it, and they were north, or they probably weren't west, because that's a whole lot of water there, but we don't know exactly where they came from, and we don't know what star they saw in the east either. Whether the star was in the east or they were in the east, we're not really sure about the star. There's lots of speculation. In fact, you can have a little bit of Christmas fun by looking up the Star of Bethlehem on the internet and seeing what the latest speculation is about what it is they saw. There's some notion that there was some sort of conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter, and maybe Mars came in there, and Saturn is considered to be the star of the Jews because they worshipped on Saturday, and that's linked to Saturn, so he's the Jews' star. Of course, it's a planet, but they wouldn't know that. And then Jupiter's the king, so king of the Jews. And then Mars is the god of war, so the king of the Jews has come to Earth to go to the war. I mean, there's lots of ideas about what they might have seen. The big point is that nobody really knows what they saw, but we're left to speculate. There's only a few things we do know about these people. We know they came to Jerusalem on a mission, and their mission was that they were under the impression, which turned out to be true, that a child had been born who was born to be king. And they went to the capital city of the land of which he was to be king in order to inquire about his birth. They came to Jerusalem to see the one born king. And it must have been that as they came, they passed many, many people who would have wondered and maybe even asked, "What's the commotion? Why are you traveling? What are you hoping to see?" They must have told many, many people that they were on the way to see one who was to be born a king of the Jews. And it's a remarkable thing, if we can pick up from the silence of the account, that no one seems to have decided to fall in with them. We know that there was at least 2 of them, maybe there were 3, maybe there were 10 or 12, but it doesn't tell us anything about a crowd of thousands who eventually got to the destination with them because they decided to follow. And that's all the more remarkable from what else we know. We know that their arrival in Jerusalem caused a great stir. They went to the palace, they went to the king. They thought King Herod would know something about the birth of the new king, and of course he didn't. It's part of the story. But it says in Matthew's account that Herod was greatly troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. So the fact that the king had heard from these men that a king was to be born and he was troubled caused a stir throughout the whole city. City with a population of many dozens of thousands of people, and it wasn't too much of an overstatement to say that the whole city was in a stir. So they caused that stir by showing up. And then we know from reading the account that their efforts were successful, and they found the child. They found Jesus, no longer in a stable. It says he was in a house, but that would be because their journey would have taken quite some time, and the vacancy problem in regard to the hotels of Bethlehem was all settled by the time they got there. And when they saw him in the house where he was being kept, they worshipped him and they gave him gifts. We're left to speculate why they gave him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. Gold, people say, is a gift fit for a king. And they gave gold because he was to be a king. That could be true, but on the other hand, gold is a gift plenty fit for a really poor person. when it all comes down to it, give the gift that says you care, give cash. So maybe giving gold was because he was from a poor family, don't know. Frankincense and myrrh are both incense and considered beneficial for medicinal reasons, and they were in the healing arts, so maybe it was just the kind of gift they always brought when they came for dinner. Or maybe they had other things in mind. Incense is used for worship, and maybe they understood that the one to be born king, as the gold gift indicates, was more than a king, but was God in the flesh. And so they came to worship him with incense. Maybe that's what that's about. Myrrh is also used as a herb for embalming. And maybe they had notions of the fact that he was coming not only to live as king, but to die. But that's highly speculative. The fact is they found the child, they worshiped him, they gave gifts. And that is why, more or less, we give gifts now. The tradition of giving gifts because Christ was born started with those men back in those days. And of course, it's the gift giving of Christmas that splits the house every year. There are those in the house when they see the pile of gifts under the tree who are filled with joy and excitement. Children, for example. And they say, look at this. I don't want this ever to end. And then there's the other people in the crowd. This is perhaps parents, people with loaded credit cards. And they look at the load of presents under the tree and they say something similar, but they say it differently. They say, I don't want this. Is it ever to end? The house is divided over the giving of gifts, but it was the wise man who got us started on that. And that's all we know about them. They came to Jerusalem. Their arrival caused a great stir. They found the child, they worshipped him, and they gave gifts. But we can deduce some things about their journey and about their success. We can deduce a number of things, and then we can learn from them. So let's start deducing. We can deduce something about the birth and life of Christ just from the fact that Matthew tells us about these people who caused a great stir in Jerusalem, and Luke, the other gospel writer who tells us about the birth of Christ, doesn't mention a word about them. While Luke talks about shepherds and never gets around to talking about the wise men, Matthew talks about the wise men, never mentions the shepherds. Mark, another gospel writer, doesn't mention anything about the birth of Christ, and John doesn't either. But at the end of John's gospel, you got Matthew with the wise men, and Mark with no mention of the birth, and Luke who talks about the shepherds, and John doesn't talk about any of it either. John at the end says, these deeds Jesus did, and other deeds he did, which if they were written down, I suppose, he says, all the books in the world could not contain what he did. Which is to say that the life and the birth of Christ really is too marvelous for words. And whereas Matthew and Mark and Luke and John for themselves do their part to give us a record of the life and the words and the deeds and the significance of the life of Christ, they're all just taking a tiny slice of a huge pie. Because this is, after all, the central and most important event of human history. To understand the dimensions and the significance of the birth and the life of Christ is like climbing Mount Everest. And you're not going to be able to climb the whole thing. You're going to have to pick one path. And so you strategize your one path, realizing that there's a whole lot of the mountain you're never going to get to because you can only see a certain part of it. Coming to understand the significance of the life of Christ is like that. We can deduce that from the fact that only one of the gospel writers even tells us about this spectacular coming to the city and finding the Christ child by these people from far away. We can also deduce something about the extent of God's purposes in the birth of Christ. As Luke tells the story, he covers the fact that angels appeared to some working men, some lowly shepherds, who were just doing their work in the fields, looking after the sheep, and suddenly the sky was ablaze with an appearance of angels to make sure that the shepherds didn't miss the birth of Christ. And meanwhile, up in the heavens, the planets and the stars were doing something of significance to people who lived many hundreds of miles away, who were of some sort of upper class of magicians or astrologers or wise men of some sort. And what we see when we put those together is the universality of the significance of the birth of Christ. God made sure by the events of that first day that lowly people like shepherds and exotic people like the wise men would not miss out on the coming of Christ, because the coming of Christ was to be of significance to all people everywhere for all time. From the fact that these wise men came from many hundreds of miles away because they saw signs in the heavens above shows us something about the extent of God's purposes. God's purposes in the birth and the life of Christ are for everybody all around the world. And then we also see deductively something about human nature. Again, the fact that however many wise men there were when they started the journey, it seems from the record that there was just exactly that number, period, at the destination when they saw Christ. You know, it's been estimated that if there were three wise men bearing gifts, there must have been an entourage of about 150 people, because in those days, traveling any great distance was a very dangerous thing, and if you came with riches, it was practically stupid to even try without a large force of soldiers, and then there would be cooks and attendants to put up the shelters and so on. So even if there were only three wise men, there would have been an entourage of about 150 people, causing a huge stir for miles and miles and miles. And there must have been many, many people who heard what they were doing and why they were traveling and what they're hoping to see, but no one thought to join them, which is to say something about human nature. It must be something about us that we can hear that something very significant is going on, that we can know that the records show that it's of great importance, and then leave it at that. Just leave it at that, like the man working in the field, 2 hours walk from Niagara Falls, never bothered to investigate it. So if that's what we can deduce, then there are a few things we can learn from the wise men, and learning from wise men is always a good idea. We can learn what they did that we can do as well. We can follow their example, so to speak. Starting with this, here are people who came to understand that Christ had been born and decided that just knowing that fact wasn't enough. They wanted to learn more. They decided to learn. They decided to find the Christ. They decided to make contact with him, and they are examples to us in that. When Jesus grew to be a man and began to teach, he said that the very essence of life, the very purpose of life, is to know God and to know Jesus Christ, whom God has sent. So these men, many years before Jesus said those words, were right on the cutting edge of God's purposes for mankind. They decided to find the Christ. They decided to put the effort into it. They were going to take the pains that were involved in getting to where the Christ was so they could see him. And then they showed their wisdom in a way that is an example to us, in that they asked around. They had a general idea of where to go, and then they had to figure out who to ask. So they went to the king, thinking that he would know something about the birth of a new king, and they asked him. And they are an example to us in that. If you're visiting with us tonight, if you're one of our guests, we're so glad that you're here. Let me just tell you this about church life here at West London Alliance. The church family is comprised of a whole lot of people who, like the wise men, have learned to ask others how to find Christ, how to develop a personal relationship with Christ. And as a matter of fact, I'll let you know, we have, in addition to Sunday services, we have a number of small groups, a number of Bible studies, a number of other groupings of people, which to a large extent is comprised of people who just want to know more about what God was doing when he sent Christ into the world. And you'll be pleased to know, I think, that our services are wide open on Sundays. You're welcome to join us any Sunday where we look into God's Word week by week and seek to learn from one another what we can learn about how to have a personal relationship with Christ. The wise men showed us how. They decided to find the Christ, and then they asked around. And something else we see about them in line with that is whenever they learned something, they took the next step. When Herod gathered the Bible scholars of his day around and said, "So what do you know from the scriptures about the birth of Christ?" They were able to say, "Well, the prophet said he'd be born in Bethlehem." And the story for the wise men would have stopped if they just said, interesting, and just stayed in Jerusalem. But they took the next step and went the next journey, the leg of the journey, to Bethlehem. When they learned something new, they followed up on that. And there's an encouragement to us. If we see something that we can do, some new way of learning about the Christ, it would be wise for us to do so. One other thing about the wise men, they didn't come empty-handed. Whoever it was that had the gold, and whatever he meant, whoever it was that was packing the frankincense and the myrrh, they came not only to receive, they came not only to learn, they came not only to see the Christ, but they came to give. They came with what they had. And the Bible instructs us that that is good advice for all of us as we come to Jesus, as we come into a more intimate relationship with Him. We should come prepared to give. We talked last Sunday about responding to God's great love in kind, responding to Him in a way that corresponds to what He's done for us. Christmas is the time we celebrate the fact that God loved the world this way. He gave His only begotten Son. And if we are to respond in kind, the gift that we should bring is not gold or frankincense or myrrh or any material thing, but rather the gift that we ourselves can be, giving ourselves, giving our attention, giving our lives to God is the way to properly respond to what He has done when He gave His Son to us. So these are the lessons of the wise men, and wisdom is a good thing for us to add to our lives as we have opportunity. The Bible tells us that these things are written for our instruction and for our development as people who are in a right relationship with God. And as we follow their example at this time of year, perhaps we can grow in wisdom and grow in God's purposes for us. So let's pray and ask God to work that work in our hearts as we consider these truths.